And good morning, everybody, and a very happy new year. Here's hoping for a fabulous 2017. Great to be back with This Is Your Racing Life, and we're going to bounce the new year with a good friend and a man who's spent a lifetime in racing, and that's what we're here to talk about. He's been one of our foremost racing riders here in Melbourne. He's covered a lot of ground in the sport of kings and also in golf, and he's a great guy on top of that. Brian Meldrum, Drum, good morning.
Good morning, Brian. If I can live up to that, well, I'll be trying. I will be trying. Well, that's a lovely intro. Thank you, Brian.
Great to see you.
Thanks, mate. Yeah, it's great to be here. It's I haven't been here for a while. I used to did a golf show here with Andrew Cues. You know,
yeah,
Andrew.
Yes,
and
I do.
We used to come in and talk about golf. And yeah, no, it's good. It's a great. But yeah, it's racing's been my life. It's I wanted to be a jockey when I was very young. And got too heavy. Well, I was told that I was too heavy. My dad, I refused to believe it until I was 14. I said, no, I'll be fine.
You and still sort of look jockey size. I know you're on the worst end of 60.
Well, these days, Brian, I'd probably be too small to be a jockey.
As we get older, we shrink, don't we?
We do. But they're a lot taller today. But funnily enough, today probably I could have made it, so to speak. But my dad ended up taking me down to Des Judd, who'd been in the war.
Yeah, with. Yeah, wonderful.
And Des Judd told me, son, he said, you can be a jockey. He said, you'll be fine. He said, you're 16, I can take you on. He said, a couple of years. He said, you can be a jockey. He said, then you'll get too heavy. And he said, then what are you going to do? In those days, Brian, there was no other pathways, you know. So I sort of realised that that was it.
You know, that's interesting because when I was sort of 13, 14, I wanted to be a jockey. And I went for the school holidays to a trainer down on the peninsula at Somerville called Jack McCarthy.
Right.
And I had 2 weeks with Jack McCarthy, you know, trying it out. And I think I sat on a couple of horses in the morning and were allowed to walk them. There was a horse called Sports Glove, who was a good sprinter at the time. And I met Mr. Pat Hyland and Mr. Alan McLean, the jockeys. I remember Jack McCarthy giving me a lift back to the station to come back home to Camberwell. And as he put me on the train, he said, good luck, son, but he said, you won't make it, your feet are too big. And I got back, I think I cried all the way home because I wanted to be a jockey. I wanted to be like Jeff Lane. I wanted to be a jockey.
I'd never heard that one before.
So there's two BMs, both wanted to be jockeys.
But that's probably, what he was probably alluding to was your feet are too big. In other words, you're too heavy boned. That was
my
problem.
Exactly.
I was very small, but my bones were too heavy, or would get too heavy, and that's what they knew. So it'd be the same thing, but you wouldn't have been able to get him in the stirrups.
And, you know, Brian, when we look back on, you know, your lifetime in racing and my career, which has been 40-plus years in racing, it's a lot safer in the grandstand, in the media box or in the press or the broadcast box. I'm glad I'm not out there.
I think we chose the right path.
Maybe.
We went the right way.
Someone was intervening, you know, when we came with a fork in the road. But you grew up around the Kyabram district. Is that your base?
Yes, I lived in Kyabram. I lived in Kyabram from the time I was about 6 or 7. And I lived there until I left town to come down to Melbourne. I worked for the Kyabram Free Press. When I couldn't be a jockey, I actually got an interview at Wright Stevenson, you know, the bloodstock agents as they were then.
They were at Flemington.
Well, their headquarters were in the city, St Kilda Road.
Yeah.
So I came down for an interview. I got an interview with them because I wanted to work with the horses, you see. Anyhow, the guy talked to me and that, you know, we chatted and I can still see it now. I'm sitting across the desk from him and then he said, I think you sound, you know, he said, I can see you're very passionate about this. He said, there is one thing about it, though. He said, we are basically primarily a seed and grain merchants. He said, the bloodstock division's a very small part of our business. He said, you'd have to work in the seed and grain department for before you actually went in there. And I said, oh, and how long would that be? And he said, 10 years.
Oh.
And I said, oh, okay. I said, oh, well, look, thanks very much for the interview and I'll get in touch with you. But I could see him having this sly little grin because he thought, this bloke won't be coming back. And he was right. I never went back near the place.
10 years selling chaff.
Yeah, exactly. So then I sort of thought, oh, you know, so I thought I'll become a racing writer. I know it sounds, you know, a bit airy-fairy, but oh, yeah. So I actually got a job on the local paper at the Free Press. Very lucky to get a job there. But I got a job as an accountant, with an assistant accountant with a view to doing some journalism.
Oh, yeah.
Well, after 6 months, my accountancy, we used to do at school, we used to do CPP, Commercial Principles and Practice, which was a sort of accountancy. And 1 year we did it by correspondence. Anyhow, mid-year exams came. We had a guy called Pierce who used to oversee us, and there was about 8 of us in the class. And he came and he said, I've got the results of the mid-year exams. And Oh, everyone said, oh, great. And he said, very pleased to announce, and you know this guy, Brian, he said, very pleased to announce, he said, Ian Purdy, with a with a score of 98 out of 100, has topped the state for correspondence, for those doing this course by correspondence. Oh, fantastic, Purdy, you know, a bit of a clap. He said, but, he said, we've created some sort of a record here. He said, because out of the 262 people who completed this exam, he said, Brian Meldrum has managed to get the bottom of the class with 7 out of 100. Now, that's how good I was at accountants.
Oh,
and after 6 months at the Free Press, I was about ready to be turfed out. And then the sports journalist, a guy called Gus Underwood, who all the harness racing people would know, he owned Claudie's Princess, the really good mayor who's been. And Gus... left to go to the Holy Grail. He was going overseas or something, and so I got the job on 3 months trial. Paul Easton, the editor, got 3 months trial. Gus turned up back in 2 weeks. I thought, oh God, you know, but Paul wouldn't hire him back on. So I stayed there for 5 years.
Yeah, now when you're working for a country newspaper, the Kyabram Free Press, you write everything, don't you? You go to the Kyabram shows, you'd be going to the food stalls, you'd be going to the footy, the cricket. But a great grounding for where you want to go.
Absolutely. You did actually write everything. I came on as a sports writer, but you covered the courts, you did all of those things. And the sports writing, like for instance, during the cricket season, there's the Kyabram District Cricket Association, there was something like 20 matches in 3 grades. I had to have all that done by Monday evening to go, and I had to do all the ladders, all the writing, all that. It was a fantastic grounding in journalism, and I'm forever thankful for that, because it did me good stead when I came down to town. I had some money saved up to go overseas. This was in 1970, and I actually went to the MoMA races this particular day. It was in there. I was working at the cannery part-time to raise the money for this. I was working at nights at the cannery and days at the Free Press. And I had all this money, I had about $300 saved to go overseas, and went to the MoMA races and had a pretty bad day. So I didn't go to work at the cannery that night. I stayed and punted on the trots. By the time the trots were over at the showgrounds, I'd virtually blown all that money. And then I went to the cannery on Sunday night, and the boss said, you know the rules, Brian. If you don't work Saturday night, you can't work Sundays because of the overtime things. Yeah. And then he said to me, I don't think your heart's in this. He said, I think you should finish up tonight. So I went into the office the next morning.
You got no money, you'd just been sacked.
Exactly. I went into the office on Monday morning, the Free Press office, and Pert had actually come on as the accountant. He took my job as the assistant accountant. He'd been in the bank. It's a bit of a merry-go-round.
Yeah.
He said, son, he said, Pert, very young, but he said, you've got to get your life in order. I sat down, I said, right, I will. I thought, what will I do? I said, I know what I'll do. I wrote identical letters to the Sun, as it was in the Sun News Pictorial.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote an identical letter to the Age. The only difference was and I just told them I was thinking of going overseas. I'd done a 5-year cadetship, wanted to be a racing writer. Never heard from the Age. Got a phone call from the Sun 2 days later. Harry Gordon rang me up and said, well, he was the editor. He said, we might have a space for you down here. Come down for an interview. Bang, got the job. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
So that's there is losing on the punt does have some advantages.
It opened the door.
Was
it a good door? We'll go back to that one shortly. Now let's go back to Kyabram. Growing up, young boy, smitten by the punt at a pretty young age. SPing, betting.
Of course. I can actually remember one day in the pub. Everyone else was playing cricket. I loved the horses, the horses more than the punt, but naturally one follows the other one way or the other. And I was in a guy called Kevin Brown was the SP in the commercial hotel at Kyabram. Anyhow, come the last race at Moonee Valley, he came to me, he said, Brian, he said, you're in a bit of trouble here. And I said, I said, I know. He said, I think I'm going to have to stop your betting. And I said, can I have one last bet? One last bet. He said, right. He said, I'll tell you what do I owe you? He said, and a cut from memory, it was something like 60 quid, which I was only earning about 10 quid a week.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, I said, one last bet. I said, I want to back a horse. Can I back it to get out? And if I get out, I won't bet again. He said, well, you certainly won't be betting again. Yeah, but you can have that. And I had 10 pounds, it was either £10 or $10, it was around about that time. I had 10, whatever it was, on a horse called Paul Levy in the last at Moonee Valley.
Mm-hmm.
and up it got. I can remember sitting, I was about the only guy in the saloon bar, and I'm sitting there listening to this race, and up it got. And next minute, the door flew open, and Kevin Brown says, "That's it, you're finished." He said, "No more betting for you." And I felt like saying, "Bloody oath, you're right."
Goal umpiring of the local footy, transistor in your pocket, listening to the races, letting the players know who'd won the first leg of the quaddie. Well, does that ring a bell?
When we were at school, high school, I was too small to be a footballer. I loved me cricket. Right. I wasn't much of a good of it, but I loved cricket. But I couldn't play footy. But Perd played footy. He was a bit of a goal sneak.
This is Ian Purdy.
So he'd be down in the forward pocket, and we'd be playing sort of sides from around the district, you know.
Tom Gala and Shepherd.
Tony Stanhope, Tatura Tat. Anyhow, in the school competition. So, anyhow, we'd be down. I was the goal umpire, and I'd have the bag there, and I'd have the transistor in the bag, and Pert would be in the forward pocket. So, we'd be listening to the legs of the quaddie. It was so much fun. And the local billiard room was a hive of activity. We used to congregate in there, and old Dimps Williams, who ran the billiard room, used to go in next door to the TAB, was next door, and he'd go in there and put our bets on for us. Every now and again, a guy called Sergeant Ben Smith, Perd and I's old mans would get Ben, "You've got to get those kids out of the beer room." So someone at the old Ben Smith's coming. So if he was coming down the alley, we'd run out the front. If he was coming in the front, we'd run down the alley.
Tell me about a horse called a Pardoris.
Gee, you know a lot about me.
Yes, I do.
This is extraordinary. Horse called Pardoris was trained by a guy called... he was owned by a guy called Lindley Graham from Merrigan.
Yeah.
And I used to go and strap him at the races, and he ran at Elmore one day, ran last in the Elmore Cup, and he'd come from Tassie.
He won a Launceston Cup,
but that was a fair way back from the time he ended up around our area. Anyhow, I strapped him and I put him on the float, and Lindley said, "You've been looking for a horse, you can have this bloke, I'll lend him to you if you want to have him." And I said, that'd be fantastic. He said, "Come and get him next Sunday." So that was a week later. So the following Sunday, I hitchhiked out to Merrigan, the other side of Merrigan, and there was no one home. So he let me know. He said, "If we're not there, there's a saddle there you can have, and it's a bridle." He said, "I need to get them back. You'll have to get your own." But he said, "To get him home." So I saddled him up, put this bridle on him, which was a pretty risky old bridle. The reins were frayed and that, you know. So I headed off, and he cantered into Merrigan like, no, I thought, how good's this? He just came. So it was only about a mile into Merrigan, but then I had to come out the other side, and it was about 7 miles to Kai. We got out the other side. Well, he obviously thought he'd done his preliminary, because out the other side he took off. So all the way home, and I kid you not, I often think of this. At one point we were galloping along the verge on the what they call the drover's trail, which is where they used to drove sheep, beside the fences. And we were going through these trees, gum tree. I thought I was going to get killed. And I eventually pulled him up about 2 miles out of Kai. Well, he'd done it about a couple of times. And then I said, no, I've got to walk. And so I walked him back to Kai. Got round to all the boys were playing. We used to play poker on Sunday Arvo at a guy called the local Garbo's place, Tim Hooper. Timmy was a trots driver. So he said, "When we're finished here," I said, "we'll go over the track," because the old Kai Abram racetrack was still there, but they used to train trotters on it.
Yeah.
And Tim said, "I'll get a noseband for him. We'll fix him up." So anyhow, while Tim's rummaging around, all the boys said, "Oh, take him out on the track, take him." And there was a golf course, the par 3 golf course, which is now a great golf course, but it was sort of round the track and across the track. So anyhow, I went out on this horse and just trotted him down, and I just kicked him to turn him to go back. We're going the wrong way, and he just took off again. So here we go. So I'm hooting around this race course at 35 mile an hour. He's flying. So anyhow, the most remarkable thing, here I am sort of thinking, I was okay, but the reins were pretty far. I think, geez, I hope these reins hang on. But then I spied out of my eye someone hitting off on the sixth hole, which went across. I thought, oh, that'll be low. I'll get hit by a golf ball here. I mean, the chances of getting hit by a golf ball, he got round to the winning post. I couldn't pull him up. But as soon as he got round, all the boys are there cheering and clapping. Just pulled up of his own accord. Job done. But he was The night I brought him back from Merrigan, the night I got him, Mum and Dad had gone down to town and they weren't coming back, supposedly, until the Monday. And this vile, I put him in a paddock about two doors down from our place. Anyhow, Wickham's paddock it used to be called. So I wake up at about 11, half past 11 at night, and there's a violent electrical storm. I'm like, oh, bloody horse. So I go down, he's going berserk, running around the paddock. I'm like, oh, bloody hell, it's pissing rain. So I go and get him, and where am I going to put him? I thought, I'll put him in our garage. So I put him in the garage. I put him in the garage, you see. So anyhow, I just go back to bed. the next minute, the old man's saying, what the? And it's pitch dark and that. They decided to come home early because and they drove home. They got home at about 12:30, 12:45, and it's raining. And they pull in the drive, and Dad gets out of the car, hunched up, runs around, opens the garage doors, and there's a racehorse in the garage. Oh, we had some fun.
This is your racing life. There's some great tales coming up. Stay with us. Brian Meldrum, the drum, racing rider extraordinaire. Great storyteller. We'll be back after this break. I'm with Brian Meldrum for Tobin Brothers Funeral, celebrating lives. We are celebrating a great life in racing. Well, not over yet by a long shot.
I'll know where to go to.
30% off. Drummer, you're finally working your way down towards Melbourne to be the racing rider. You want to be a racing rider. Just going back again to those early days, first Melbourne Cup. About 9 years of age?
First Melbourne Cup.
Straight draw?
No. Evening the first Melbourne Cup I recall was, and I stayed home to listen to it, actually. I pretended to be sick. And Dad had gone off to work, and I knew he wouldn't forfeit, but Mum did. And it was Rising Fast in 1954.
54, yeah.
And it was actually ridden by Jack Purtell.
That's right.
And Dad's favourite jockey was Jack Purtell, so Jack became my favourite jockey too. But I remember lying in bed. I can still see it, lying in bed, listening to the Melbourne Cup 1954.
Now, they tell me the first one you went to, you're 9 years of age. Would that be right?
My dad took me down to see the Caulfield Cup in 1957.
Yeah.
The Tullock one.
Yeah.
And we were in the Guinness stand. I can, way down on the home turn.
Yeah, there. What a view.
And it was, and it, like, yeah, it's sort of, I was 11 years old, and I can't conjure up the memory of it, but the only memory I can have is the horses coming around the home turn. But I mean, and when I ask, when people say to me, what's the best horse you've ever seen? I can say Tullock, but I didn't appreciate Tullock, to what he was. I knew what he was and that sort of thing, but I mean, I don't say, but that was the first time I went to the. That wasn't the first time I went to the races. My dad had taken me in 1956 to the Easter, the Monday meeting at Flemington, because they used to have the Melbourne Racing Club used to race at Flemington because it was the old Williamstown, and they used to race all over the place before they settled it. They ended up at the VATC, and that was the first race meeting I went to in town. And then I went in 1957 and saw Tullock in the Caulfield Cup. First Melbourne Cup I saw, I think, was 1960,
Hijinks.
Yeah.
Tullock ran favourite
in seventh. Yeah, that was the first.
Yeah, the centenary. The time overseas before you actually, when did you actually dig in to sort of take the job in Melbourne?
Actually, I came down in 1970 to take the job. It was under Jack McPherson was the chief racing rider. Dudley Zillman was second. Keith Hillier was the third in charge.
Young Keith at the time.
He was the young gun. And I came down and I was there for 2 years. But I still wanted to go overseas. I really did want to go overseas when I was young. And so I actually resigned. I mean, people were falling off chairs. My dad just couldn't believe it. That I'd got the job that I always wanted. And I resigned. I resigned in the end of 1971. I told them I wanted to go. And I left to go overseas in 72. And I went over to England. And I lived in England, based in England, for about 3 years. Came back in 75.
What'd you do there?
I wanted to go over there and sort of work on the papers, but the National Union of Journalists over there was very, very powerful, so it was almost impossible to get a job there in the newspapers. I could have worked for Australian Associated Press, but I thought, well, that's like Colston, Newcastle. I mean, So I just did all sorts of things. I worked in factories, a bit of work on railway sleepers. That wasn't my cave. It was too hard. We worked in a brewery once and just did this, that, and the other, So.
And did you get to the racing?
I used to go to the races a fair bit. Yeah. I actually went to. I saw Crisp at Cheltenham in the Gold Cup when he ran an odds-on favourite in the Gold Cup in 1972. 73. Sorry, 72. When did I go there in 70? No, yeah, 72. I went 73, in the March of 73, and he was odds on favourite. They were actually betting bar one, any price you like, bar one. He ran fourth, but Fred Winter, his trainer, had been saying how he was thinking of running him in the Grand National. Everyone's saying, oh, he's a 2 mile chase. How could he ever win the Grand National? But I thought to myself, this is a 2 mile chase. But I reckon he gave them fair dinkum 45 length start from the mile post, and he ended up running fourth, and he got beaten by about 10 or 12 lengths. But I walked away and I thought, he might be right, this bloke. This bloke could win the National. So, as you know, less than a month later,
what a
performance.
He won the
I cried. I mean, it was the saddest thing. When he came back to scale, he was so tired that he was buckling at his fetlocks. He virtually couldn't stand up. But it was just the most. I believe that's the greatest performance that I've ever seen of a racehorse.
Yeah, we're talking about a champion steeplechaser here called Crisp in the early 70s. He swept all before him here in Victoria and went across to the leading jump trainer in Fred Winter over there in the UK. Raced by Sir Chester Manifold. He led by, at one stage, I think he was nearly two fences in front in that Grand National.
Yeah, he was a bit over a fence in front.
Yeah.
He was sort of landing as the others were taking the fence behind.
And he came over the last fence, through the dog leg, onto the course proper, probably still 20 lengths in front, 15 to 20. He's getting a little weary, back to about 10.
By the time he jumped the last, Red Rum had probably got it back to about just under 15 lengths. Wouldn't have been any more than that. But what happened was that when he jumped, like when they jumped the last in the Grand National, when they do the first circuit, the last fence actually, they keep going straight on and down to a fence called the chair, which is a fantastic fence. Yeah. When they come around the second time, they jump that fence before the chair, but then they, as you say, they dogleg across to the right and get onto the course proper. And both the horse was tired, and Richard Pittman rode the horse, and he was very tired as well. Because what had happened was, when he set off on the race, he realised after they jumped about two fences, he was trying to sort of steady him on. But every time he saw a fence crisp, he would just grab the bit and go at it. And Pittman realised that if he fought him like that, that was going to be no good. So what he was doing was he'd let him go at each fence, just let him go, and he'd jump it, and then he'd sort of grab him up. When you let him go and grab him up for about 30-odd fences, he was so tired, Pittman. The horse tried to go straight on. And Pittman's desperately trying to get him on the offside rein to come to the right and go out the thing. And that cost him, I reckon, and Red Rum was making a beeline from that fence straight across to the corner. I reckon that cost Chris probably at least 5 or 6 lengths, it only had to cost him, he got beaten 3/4. Yeah. That's what cost him the race. A lot of people criticise Pittman, but Pittman was as tired as the horse. And he's desperately, if you watch the film of it, you can see him desperately trying to get him to come round, but he doesn't come round until he finally sort of spots the elbow, and then he went to that. I reckon he was in front, seriously, I reckon he was in front no less than 20 yards from the line. And horses take big strides. Mm. 20 yards is about two strides. It was the most
dramatic to watch, isn't it?
It was. Yeah. You
know. Sir Peter O'Sullivan, the great broadcaster who went for 50 years for the BBC, he described Crisp's performance being beaten by Red Rum, and they broke the record by 12 seconds, I think it was.
18
seconds. He said it's the greatest performance, even though he got beaten, in the history of the National.
You talk to people. I've been to England a fair bit because my wife comes from England. I met my wife over there, Jill, and so we go back. We've gone back a fair bit over the last 30 years, 40 years. And you talk to anyone over there about racing, and the older people about racing, they just revere Crisp over there. I mean, we reckon he was great. They revere him over there. Mm. They love him.
Yeah, Brian, in the time that you were working back with the Sun and the Herald, etc. You came through those golden years of the 70s and the 80s and into the 90s, and I did too as a broadcaster. They were fabulous years for racing.
They really were. They were fabulous years for racing. They were a fabulous time to be involved in racing, and particularly for you and I, who were right at the forefront of it, doing our various our respective jobs. You as a broadcaster, myself as a journalist. Mm. It was just magical. I mean, Brian. It was an industry then, but in a sense it was a fledgling industry, in inverted commas. It was more a way of life, and as much as there was it was a pretty serious business at the racing end, but there was also a sense of fun about it.
Yes,
and you'd go to the races and you'd genuinely have a lot of fun. Even working would
exactly.
have a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You know, blokes like Tosca Curtin and old Bonnie Hoisted and
Jeff Murphy.
And you get to
Races. Was there a greater character in your time and our time, pound for pound, than George Hanlon?
Oh, He's seriously. My idol. He yeah. is seriously.
And you wrote George Hanlon about George
I
Hanlon.
Love George.
You wrote him beautifully because you'd worked him out a long way from home.
I gave the eulogy at his funeral.
I know, I was there.
You were there, yeah. Oh, mate, I just loved George. I mean, because he was such a complex character. Mm. I mean, he was a brilliant trainer, fantastic trainer. Oh. But
Three
Melbourne
yeah.
Cups. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Piping Lane, which he sort of got that from the Trinders.
Black
but he
Knight
got in right
and
there,
R1.
And R1, yeah. But he was, but well, you know, but oh, look, I mean, the stories I could tell about George, I mean, it was just, if George won a race, you would never miss a press conference.
Yes.
Because you never knew what he was going to say. I can still recall a horse of Robert Holmes' Court won the last at Caulfield. It was around about early September, you know, it was just before the start of the Spring Carnival. Won pretty well. And it was raining, so we all crowded down into the corridor leading to the jockey's room. So we're in the corridor, and everyone was sort of, this horse had won pretty impressively, and guys are sort of going, you know, wanting to know whether he was going to go into the spring, you know. So I remember Johnny Greensall, the truth, he said, oh, George, he said, this horse, he said, is there any chance of him spring? Oh, well, he said, Robert will make. He said, Robert, oh, Robert's a, you know, this is Holmes' Court. He said, oh, Robert, he's a great owner. He's a lovely fellow. So, and someone else said, yeah, but George, this horse, would he, you know, what would you set him for? Oh, well, he said, well, we'll have a look. Robert will probably, you know, off he goes on Robert again. And so this went on for, I reckon, 2 or 3 minutes. Every time someone asked a question, George would eulogise about Robert Holmes' Court. So fine, I'm up the back, and I sort of got an inkling of what was going on, you see. So yeah. There was a bit of a lull, and I said, excuse me, George. I said, why is Robert such a great owner? He said, you never hear from him. Yeah, for George, that was the epitome of a good owner. I remember at Sandown one day, I walked through the mounting yard, and it was a beautiful balmy day, and it was right between races, and George is out leaning on the winner's stall, you know, the winner's thing.
Petition,
you know,
yeah.
Petition, and I sort of wandered over, how are things, George? Oh, hello, son, yeah, how are you? Good, yeah, blah, blah, blah. And I'm sort of, you know, I talked to him for a few seconds, or a minute, half a minute or so, and then I'm sort of racking my brains to think, because I'd done the form, you know, you had to do the form for the paper and that. I'm thinking, what's he, I can't think. So how many have you got into it? None. Haven't got a runner. I said, really? He said, yeah. He said, forgot to accept. I said, what? He said, had four in, forgot to accept with them. I said, really? And he's giggling away. I said, oh, that was bad. He said, oh, yeah. He said, oh. He said, the owners. He said, they were furious.
So what was he doing at the races?
George, as you know, when horse, didn't matter what the race was, George would always go down the winner's stall.
Yeah.
And let's say Murph trained a winner. George would be circling it, having a look at its hind. He'd look at winners just to see what they were made up like. You know, he'd be looking around. You know, he was always at the races.
Amazing.
He knew nothing else.
Amazing. As you say, they're wonderful characters. And I'm reading the book Board Odds I Lay at the moment.
Oh, okay.
Which has been produced by Johnny Adams and edited by you, the history of bookmakers here in not only Victoria but Australia-wide. And I'm really enjoying it because it takes me back to those wonderful, colourful characters and the buzz and the smell and the sense of the racetrack, which we loved. There was something about it because the bookies would be spruiking their prices regardless of whether it be Flemington, Caulfield, Bendigo, Werribee, Stony Creek. And that's what gave us atmosphere. It was a buzz around the circuit. It's as dead as a doornail now.
Well,
seriously.
Absolutely. No, it is. And that's it's robbed it of so much.
Yeah.
I mean, as you say, I mean, at the height of the in the late 70s and through the 80s, it was just fantastic. And a lot of that, you're dead right, a lot of that atmosphere was created. The bookies created the atmosphere because there were dozens of them. I remember the ring at Caulfield used to, I reckon it was at least 80 yards around when you started, went round and then down the back, and there was these big oak trees in the middle of the betting ring.
Fantastic.
Because if you owed a bookie from the previous
Saturday, you could hide.
Well, you'd hide behind the trees trying to see where he was situated, you know, and you'd make a point of trying to bet with the bloke as far away as possible from the bloke you owed. But they'd be yelling and spruiking and carrying on, you know, and there was the vibrancy was just unbelievable, and as I say, it was entertainment.
Yeah.
It was apart from the racing, it was just pure entertainment. You see Paper Jack. Remember Paper Jack running up and down with his four guys sticking out of every pocket, and, you know, having a bet here. And it's really, it's very sad that aspect has been lost. And I think that
it's gone forever now.
Oh, never come back ever.
Yeah.
You can't get it back.
We're talking racing and we're talking the life of Brian Meldrum, and we'll be back in a moment. This is your racing life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. My guest this morning is Brian Meldrum, and we're talking about the days of... What do you think has been... What's the story that you've written in terms of... you were general sport from 89 to 93, covering the golf from 93 to when you retired... When did you retire? 2000 and what, five?
2003.
Three, yeah. End so you're racing editor, managing editor of the Herald Sun at the time.
In 89, I'd been there for, I came back in 75, so I'd been there for 14 years. Oh. And in that 14, Keith Hillier had taken over, and Keith ran the racing room, and he got me to come back. He said, if you're going to come back now, because Jack had retired, Jack McPherson, Dudley had retired. So I came back. And he'd put together a team that year of Keith Hillier, Bernie O'Brien, Tony Mooney, myself, Tim Havel, Roy Aspinall, and Richard Trembath, and then Richard left and Neil Donnelly came on board. And we were together for 14 years. It was unheard of. And
it was a great team, wasn't it?
It was a great fantastic team. And we were all mates, you know. Yeah. And anyhow, in 89, Keith came in one day and I'm sitting there. He said, they reckon we've got to lose one in the racing room. He said, they reckon we've got too many. I said, all right. He said, who do you reckon it'll be? I said... Well, the bloke who's going to go is about 250 million to one on, so there's no point in trying to get a bet on. He said, no, you're right about that. I said, yeah. He said, who do you reckon? I said, it's me. He said, you're right about that too. The thing about it was, and Keith was very flattering, and he understood, I loved all sport. I just loved all sport. And so Keith knew that I could go to sport and survive. So anyhow, I left there. And I was, funnily enough, Brian, I was... You know, I certainly wasn't disappointed. I was quite happy in a way because 14 years, you go to Pakenham on a cold middle of winter and the Thursday trying to find a story. It wasn't the greatest fun in the world. So I worked, and I was lucky that Mick Davis, who was the golf writer at the Sun at the time, he went to the Australian about 3 months later and he came to me. He said, mate, I'm going to the Australian tomorrow virtually. He said, get the golf job. Anyhow, remember the guy came to me, Simon Townley was there. He said, oh, look, Mick Davis is going to the, he said, do you want the golf job? And I sort of looked, and I put this look on my face as if to say, oh, no. And I could see his eyes sort of widening, and I said, of course I want the golf job. And I got that, but I did other sport because there wasn't a lot of golf. And I did that till 93 and then went overseas. I was actually going to edit the Globe, and there was big plans to raise the Globe up again as a racing paper.
Oh, yeah.
And I went overseas with Jill, went over to see her cousins and her brother. And... I was over there thinking, this is great. Checked out the Racing Post, which had just started, basically. The old Sporting Life had gone. And I had all these plans. And they rang, a guy called Chris McLeod rang me up a week before. He said, all gone. Accountants are scotched. It won't be happening. Came back, Phil Gardner, the sports editor, said, now I want you to get rid of the golf. I said, yeah, fine, whatever. He said, oh, you don't seem very enthusiastic. I said, well, racing. He said, racing? He said, you can go up and sort of be a chief of staff in the racing room again. Went up there and then... You know, then I eventually became the racing editor. Bernie was the chief racing writer, Bernie O'Brien, and I became the racing editor.
Because the papers were split up, weren't they? The Sun and the Herald were separate.
Sun and the Herald, the Herald was the afternoon paper, Sun was the morning paper, and then 1989, when Murdoch bought the place, they kept the Herald going for a while, and then they closed the Herald, and it became the Herald Sun. Yes. They merged the papers, it became the Herald Sun. They had a morning edition for a while, and then that went, so it became the Herald Sun.
Yeah. We must talk about your brother, Molly Meldrum. Yeah. Gee whiz, what was it, Christmas 2011, that fall he had at home, you nearly lost him.
Yeah, he was very, very lucky. He's the guy who, his assistant, Joe, was around, like, Joe did everything, gardening and that, and he's... And luckily, Joe was still there, and he heard this thump, and when he went out, Ian had fallen off the... He fell off it wasn't actually a ladder, it was a steps going up to a roof, and he'd been up there putting up something for his Christmas party. Why, I don't know, but down he went. And if Joe hadn't have been there, he would have gone. And Joe, he was on the phone to Yale Cohen, who was Ian's assistant. She rang the ambulance, and they got him there and put him in the Alfred. And I got a call about 8 o'clock that night that he was in there, and so I went down there. Funnily enough, Brian, I mean, he looked like a bloke just landed on Mars. He had that many tubes coming out of him. But I thought, you know, geez, son, what have you done here? But I thought, you'll be right. I knew he was pretty tough. I knew Ian was really internally very tough. So I don't know why, but I didn't think he'd die, funnily enough. And he didn't. Mm. He was unconscious for a while.
You were the spokesman for the family. You were the go-to person. And, well, he's older. He was born in 19, In fact, his birthday comes up on 29th of January 1943, so he is a tad older.
Yep.
He's an amazing person. Like, when you look back and see what Molly Meldrum's achieved, when did he get that bloody hat? When did he put that on?
I think it was in the late, early 80s, I think it was.
Is there anything underneath the hat?
Sorry?
Has he got any hair?
Can't say. Don't know. I'm serious about it now. I am. Yeah, I am. So I did see him in hospital, but I'm serious.
Do you have the hat on?
Well, I'll tell you, one day I went round there. He lives over in Richmond. And I went round there one day and one of the housekeepers came down and said, "Oh, yeah, come in, Brian." It's just, "Who's that? Who's there?" And she said, "Oh, it's Brian." He said, "Send him up. Tell him to come up." And I thought, right. And I ran. I ran and I went up there's sort of a circular stair that goes up to me. So I've run up the stairs and I've run down the passage and opened the door of the bedroom thinking, "I'll get you." And there he was sitting up in bed with a baseball cap on. It didn't work. He's too clever for me.
When you think about what he's done, like, you go back over 40 years to Countdown from 74 to 87, record producing, hits after hits, acclaimed worldwide. And it must have been amazing to you. It probably didn't surprise you for the rest of the world, the entertainment world, people like Elton John and people of that ilk, the biggest stars in the world, wanting to know how their friend was.
Yeah, he made a hell of a lot of friends. And I think that was mainly due, I mean, Ian is a very engaging person, but I also think it was due to the fact that scandal and gossip never interested him. He was always more interested about what the person was about, what they did, and how they got to their music, how they played their music. He wasn't very interested in scandal, and consequently, these people came to trust him. They trusted him because they knew they could tell him things, and he wouldn't write about it or spruik it. And I think that helped cement a lot of friendships around the world. He was very lucky. When I say lucky, he was in a job where he got to interview all these people, particularly when they'd come out here for Countdown.
And Prince Charles,
yeah, it was a brilliant interview.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing. But there you go, you see. Ian made a... Ian, because he was so down, he was so down to earth, I mean, and he stumbled around with his words, et cetera, et cetera. But that became an art form for him. Mm. And so it worked. People could see him. And look, I mean, Ian has always been... One of the masses. He was always a fan. I think that's the best way of putting it. Yeah. Ian never stopped being a fan of music, of pop music, rock and roll music, and consequently was always sort of awed by these people, And consequently, to become friends with them was fantastic.
When the Beatles came here in the mid '60s, if you look at that historic footage outside the Southern Cross, I was out there. I was out there, and the thousands of people out there in the crush of the crowd. But he actually appears sort of running alongside their car. It's a teenager.
That's what I say. He was the ultimate fan. And I went to the concert. You probably went to the concert. It's funny. I was only listening to it. I was watching a thing on the Rolling Stones last night that I'd taped. The Exile on Main Street. It's a beaut documentary if you ever get to see it.
Yes.
But I remember going to that concert, and I was singing in a band at the time, so I knew all of the Beatles songs, And I seriously believe that helped me hear them. Because you couldn't hear them. They screamed from the start of that concert to the end of the concert. They never stopped screaming. Yeah. So you can see them up there. But if you knew the songs, I think we heard them in our heads rather than we actually heard it coming off the stage at the festival hall.
And, you and Ian Molly, poles apart in the worlds that you come from. You from horse racing, him from the pop music industry. Did he ever show any interest in what you were about?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Ian, not so much to me, but it'd come back to me. Ian was, he'd always say, "Oh, yeah, my Brian's a racing writer, blah, blah, blah." So he was quite...
He acknowledged it.
He acknowledged it. Yeah, I mean, they are poles apart, those worlds. People sort of think, you're a journalist and he's a... But horse racing is further apart from even the paperback in those days. We were working in places away from the Herald building at times because... It was, racing, we'll put them there. We were never part of the mainstream. It suited us. Mm. They put us in the Australian building once. The old Lindrum's.
That's right, yes.
The hotel.
Yeah.
We ended up there once because New Zealand had bought that for the Australian. But Dolly Lindrum still had the second floor. She had a beer. They put us up on the third floor. They thought, because we'll stick them up there. And I remember Keith told us, he said, they're moving us again. Oh, charming. Yeah, we thought we'd been hardly done by. So he said, we're going over to Lindrum's. Really? So we were on the top floor. So Keith, it's sort of about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Keith said, righto, one frame we'll play, one frame. So we'd all go down and play billiards. And Keith put a fridge in there. In his huge office, and he overlooked the railway yards and that. Oh, we had a ball, but racing was like it is sort of polarized because you either love racing or you have no interest in it whatsoever.
Exactly.
And
basically, the general populace, the mums and dads, don't really have a great interest in it anyway. Which sounds odd that here we are talking about it, but it's a sport where people, hone in on 2 or 3 weeks of the year. And quite often people will say to me, after the Melbourne Cup, what do you do after that? Do you wait for the next Melbourne Cup? I said, well, actually, we go 363 days a year.
Yeah.
It's a massive, massive industry. Yeah. Brian, where are we at now? Like, we've just come through 2016. It's not really a year for the show reel, is it, how race
Anis
is going
Horribilis.
In this state. Yeah, very much
Anis
so.
Mirabilis won the other day. Anis Horribilis has been the year
racing.
Look, Brian, I don't really know. It worries me that racing relies totally, and they can argue against this all that. Racing relies totally on the punter. The money that is bet is what keeps racing going. So therefore, you have to encourage. We're not encouraging you to bet, but we need people to be betting to keep the game going. Mm. And I think that's going to be a hard thing to do, particularly just in the betting forums these days. I mean, sports betting is huge now. It's like 20 years ago, it was a minnow. And it still hasn't overhauled horse racing, but if it does, I wonder where the money's going to come from, that's all. I really do wonder where the money will come from. And I think that, but I do, and I also believe that the governance is, I'll say it's lapsed.
There's no question.
It's overweighted. It's overblown, and people haul me over the coals for that. But I do think it is. I think that the move to an independent commission has to be a good move.
Yeah.
It could not keep functioning the way it is.
Yeah.
I mean, but there's a lot of issues that it has, and I think as long as people realise that it's going to require work on everyone's part, not just a part of these people here or those people there. It will require work on everyone involved in the industry to make sure that the industry stays strong.
Yeah.
And it may require some sacrifice as well, but they've got to do it for the sake of the industry.
Yeah. And the thing too, as you say, it's about punters. It's about keeping it rolling for money coming in terms of turnover that will flow into prize money so we can race horses for decent dollars. But the key word here is integrity. You must have integrity, 110% integrity. And any lapse, any chink in the armour of integrity is a no-no. It's what stops us and slows us down their tracks. And we've had too much of it, too many problems with it.
Oh, absolutely. No doubt about that. And I will say this. I think that there's been less than the required integrity. And I also think that there's been some very bad handling of integrity issues.
No doubt.
That's complicated it. It's exacerbated the whole thing. And I think that everyone needs to step back on both sides of the fence. The stewards need to step back. The participants need to step back and just have a look at what they're doing, because we can't go through another year like the last year.
No.
As you say, integrity is everything, and by golly, it's teetering on a very, very it's teetering on the edge of a precipice at the moment. Mm. It really is.
Great to have a chat with you this morning. I've really enjoyed it. We've been friends for a long time, and I love your stories. I love your tales. We could probably go another hour. Look after yourself, Brian, and thanks for popping in.
It's been a pleasure, Brian. I really appreciate you having me in, and I wish all the punters out there and everyone else have a great new year. Have a great year.
Brian Meldrum, the Drum, as he's known to so many in racing, one of racing's good guys. This is your Racing Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating life.